Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners, to LNL, coming to you on RN and from a parallel universe. Hang on a sec. It's been a great day for Rudd supporters like myself. It's been a day of not only of victory, but of vindication and even of vengeance to see our lad carried shoulder high through cheering crowds and overwhelm. What? He didn't? He didn't even stand? You're kidding. Oh, for God's sake, no one tells me anything. What we'll have to do is convene a gathering of much more astute political observers than myself to have a look at what really happened. And here's a good idea. Let's bring together the same trio that we had at the Perth Writers' Festival. You might remember that I chaired a session with Walkley Award winner Laura Tingle from the Australian Financial Review, where she's indeed the political editor, with David Uren, economics editor of The Australian, more than 30 years reporting experience, former editor of Business Review Weekly, and co-author of Shitstorm, Inside Labour's Darkest Days. I suspect that you'll have to do a new edition to include the dark day of today. Chris Ullman, co-anchor, political editor for 7:30, a host of media credits. He's married to Labour member of the Australian House of Reps, Gail Brodman, and I welcome you back. You must all be absolutely exhausted. Laura?
Hello. all that credibility. Philip, we must be at the end of the program already.
Well, look, if you were to sum up today in a single word, what might that word be?
I can't think of a single word that words fail me.
You could use a four letter expletive. What about you, David? Have you got a single word that at least describes your own feelings?
Well, I don't know. I was expecting to read a word that I saw Laura using. I think this morning, it might have been yesterday, which was schmozzle, because I rather like the word.
Schmozzle. That's like a worse version of kerfuffle, isn't it? Really?
Something like that. Yeah.
Now, Chris, you're good at words.
With a cold.
You're good at words, as you've demonstrated in your outrageous political memoir, which I'll plug at the end. A single word from you.
Farce. What else are we supposed to say about today? You look on in complete and utter amazement at the challenge that never was.
Laura, I don't know. I feel a sense that we might not quite fully understand what went on today. I just have a sneaking conspiratorial feeling that what Simon Crean set about to do was not necessarily what we think he set about to do. There's quite a few people feeling that he helped set Rudd up.
Well, there are all sorts of theories about what Simon Crean was trying to do, Philip. I'm going to start by giving him the benefit of the doubt and thinking that what he was actually trying to do was what he actually said he was going to do, which was try to break the deadlock around events, I think possibly doing so for all the best motives. I mean, if you actually look at what Simon Crean said when he came out at 1 o'clock, he was not praising Kevin Rudd and saying Julia Gillard was terrible, or vice versa. He was saying that both of them essentially were deeply flawed characters who were causing all sorts of problems for the Labor Party in their own sort of particular way, that the government wasn't functioning and that it couldn't go on like this. And I think he was right. It might not have been the cathartic sort of end of problems as he thought might emerge, but probably it has nonetheless created a new chapter, shall we say, which I don't think it's going to be necessarily be anything other than catastrophic, but we're now seeing one by one all the Rudd supporters resigning or being sacked from the Gillard front bench, which may give some opportunity for the entire paranoid framework in which the Prime Minister has been governing for the last 12 months, certainly if not longer, lift, and maybe the government become more functional, though I'm very sceptical.
Chris, nonetheless, it has forced Rudd out of cover. It forced him to be involved for the second time in a fight that he wasn't really ready for.
No, absolutely, and he was completely unready last time and went off half-cocked overseas and was really suckered into a fight with Gillard that he wasn't going to win. And I do understand what you're saying. There is word around, if you weren't giving Simon Crean the benefit of the doubt, that he was on some kind of soul suicide bombing mission. But I do believe, and he indicated this evening, that the people in the Rudd camp were aware of it. Perhaps he went off, exploded a little bit earlier than they imagined he was going to do, because they were always trying to contrive some way that they could get around the fact that Kevin Rudd said that he wasn't going to challenge himself. Well, Simon Crean provided him with that opportunity, but he didn't take it. It's just hard to see now how another opportunity is manufactured and how Kevin Rudd's credibility really survives another tilt.
David, I see your finely tuned nostrils sniffing the winds. What impression did you have today that it was a setup, that Rudd was trapped?
Look, I'm perhaps less charitable towards Simon Crean than is Laura, but nor do I take a conspiratorial view of what he was about either. The things that struck me most about his 1 o'clock press conference was the slight note of vanity that was there, that he could be deputy leader, he could be deputy prime minister, he could bring back a few grains of that magic dust that were there over the Hawke Keating years. And not only that, he could also finish off the business of reforming Labor's internal processes, from which he was rudely interrupted in 2003 or so by Mark Latham. So I think there was a sense in which he saw what he was doing today as, you know, what we need is leadership. He could provide leadership, and whilst there was this impasse, this deadlock of which, you know, which Laura spoke, he felt that by him stepping out and showing what a leader he was, he could succeed in carrying the day. But, you know, it's at the end of the day a rather tragic performance, because he sort of, you know, marched out onto the battlefield, you know, turned around and there was nobody there, and he was duly put to the sword.
It was, yes, Jubilation T. Cornpone comes to mind. Laura, there wasn't much magic dust in Simon Crean's own leadership stage and days. Do you agree that there was a certain amount of hubris, of ego, in today's performance?
Look, there's always hubris and ego in people's performance, Philip, but there aren't all that many people left in the Labor Party. I mean, Simon Crean is the only person who actually served in what I would call a grown-up Labor government, i.e. in the latter years of the Hawke and Keating period. He was actually on the front bench. Now, I think whatever we say about what Simon Crean did today, you have to look at it in the context of what he has been saying for some time, which is that he's been appalled at the processes of the way the government's been working and all of those things. So this isn't just about him and Kevin Rudd. It's about him thinking that the government isn't functioning the way it should, and he's been on the public record on that for some time. So I think you've got to sort of really just consider that it's not just about this leadership race. Whether it's about hubris or not, I think he has a valid point to make about what was happening, and he was probably one of the few people who could actually sort of go out there and who'd be prepared to go out there and take that risk. Now, the fact that it all fell so splendidly to pieces, I think, rather discounts all the conspiracy theories about it. You know, I'm sure he's spoken to Kevin Rudd at some point and all those sorts of things, but I think what characterised today and what has been overlooked in a lot of the talk and analysis about it is that the Rudd camp was hopelessly split in the last 48 hours, in particular between those who thought that Kevin Rudd should make some sort of aggressive run for the leadership, and because it was only, if he didn't do it this week, he couldn't do it at all, and those who said, no, it's not going to work, it's got to be a conciliatory, overwhelming draft. And that group included Kevin Rudd himself, who was ringing around people last night telling him to back off. And I think in those circumstances, Simon Crean sort of came out through the middle of saying, look, it's just not viable for us to go into a 5 or 6 week parliamentary break with this whole question unresolved.
Chris, if there were splits within the Rudd camp, there's also been sharp divisions within our profession, and with a lot of journalists accusing other journalists of being party to to escalating endless talk on a leadership challenge which really wasn't there. Does the press gallery or the wider realms of journalism and punditry bear some burden of responsibility for the fiasco?
Absolutely. I think the journalists in some way or another are always part of somebody's game, and we are aware of that. But this time around, over a long period of time, what the Rudd forces were trying to do quite successfully was to create a sense of chaos around the Gillard government, and particularly in the course of the last week, and it seemed to me to be quite well orchestrated over the course of the last 4 days, that there was always something that kept this on the boil. Now, they would also say, don't forget, that a lot of the misery which is about the Gillard government and the problems of the Gillard government, absolutely self-inflicted. Like, what could be a larger own goal, and what would we be talking about this evening other than the media laws, which were so catastrophically handled? That was entirely an own goal by the Gillard government. But then any time things started to slacken off a bit, there would be someone who was feeding the fire, and the media was used this week to try and stoke the flames against the Gillard government. And absolutely, I also think that because of what happened in 2010, and because such a large chunk of the media didn't see what was brewing with Kevin Rudd, there's a paranoia that it will be missed the next time around. So that helped to fuel the flames too. And then you've got the newsrooms in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, all ringing up saying, so-and-so's got such a story, why haven't you got that? Are we going hard enough? Should we amp this thing up? So there's genuinely is a very real conversation to be had about all that. And again, it's supercharged by the fact that we now have a 24-hour news cycle, we have all of these programs that people can appear on, and politicians have become commentators on their own profession. They do that as much now as they seem to do anything else. And I think, you know, that people are going to have a really long, hard think about how they govern in future.
David, it has to be said that if Rudd couldn't gain enormously from the self-destruction that's been going on with Julia and her cohorts, he probably never could. Has the stake been finally driven through his heart, or would he rise again?
Well, I mean, I think something that we said the last time we spoke is that you can never say never, and never in, at that point proved to be not much more than 3 or 4 weeks. I think it is very difficult. I think it's been very difficult, and I think maybe there was a recognition of that in the Rudd camp today, that they don't have the numbers, they haven't had the numbers, and I think that's not just because there is loyalty to Gillard, it's also because, you know, not only do you decapitate Gillard, you decapitate Swan and Conroy and, you know, a bunch of other ministers, and you have to sort of try and erect a whole new government and a whole new team behind someone who, you know, at the end of his previous regime was very divisive, and even the people who are most pessimistic about the government's current chances would have to sort of scratch their heads and say, well, how's this going to work before crossing that Rubicon?
Laura, if there was one aspect of the chamozzle which I found particularly intriguing, is that it made Tony Abbott look prime ministerial.
Mm. It did. I mean, Tony Abbott came out and said things that you found yourself nodding your head about, about the chaos in Labor ranks. So without a doubt, he is the biggest winner out of all of this. But, you know, it is ever thus. I've got to say, I would hotly dispute Chris's assessment about the media's role in all of this. I mean, the media always has a role in these things, but this was not something where everybody went raging off saying, it's on, you know, Laurie Oakes, for example, was sort of saying, you know, well, it's sort of close, but it doesn't have the numbers. Dennis Shanahan was saying the same sort of thing. In our paper, we were saying that the numbers had tightened, but, you know, he wasn't over the line, all those sorts of things, all of which were true. The numbers had tightened. Nobody's still exactly sure what the numbers are, but without a doubt, there were people who were declaring to us a change of vote who had previously not changed their vote. Now, I think the dilemma for the media, I'm sorry, I'm not quite answering your question, but I think this is an important point. I think the dilemma for the media is, at what point are we players and at what point are we reporting what's actually going on?
There was there's another interesting parallel that suddenly occurs to me. At the last attempt against Gillard, a foreign minister was out of the country, namely Rudd. There was a foreign minister out of the country on this occasion, namely Carr. Mm. And there is a very strong suggestion, Laura, that he was one of the prominent defectors, inevitably denied. Do you pick anything up on that?
About whether he was or not?
Yeah.
Well, my working presumption was that he probably would have been, but, you know, Bob Carr's too smart to sort of nail his colours to the mast without knowing exactly where things are going to fall. Without a doubt, he made clear his dissatisfaction with a wide range of things that Julia Gillard had done, but particularly on Palestine. So, I think there are signs all over the place that there was a lot of dissatisfaction. Even people who are very, very strong supporters of Julia Gillard have been saying in the last few days that there are big problems with the government. Now, that might have been that they were conceding that Kevin Rudd was winning support that he previously didn't have, or it might have been that they were saying, look, they're both as flawed as each other, and I won't change my vote to vote for Kevin Rudd, but we can't go on as we are in this environment where the Prime Minister is making all these calls because the government's become so paranoid about Kevin Rudd that she won't talk to anybody. You know, we do have to change the way we run things if we've got any hope of looking like a government that's in control of its own destiny.
We're discussing one of the most significant days in Australian politics. A significant schmozzle, a farce with three of the best in Australian journalism. Laura Tingle, political editor of the Australian Financial Review, David Uren, economics editor of The Oz, and Chris Uhlman, co-anchor and political editor for 7:30. And Chris, I remember in Perth you were so passionate about the catastrophe taking place within the Labor Party. You asked, how could we let this happen to our heritage? Well, it's going to get worse from here, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually think, and I was talking to one of the senior ministers today who is a Gillard supporter, who was saying that she thinks that there's a cultural sickness in the Labor Party and doesn't really know how that might be sorted. And I do think that is something that the Labor Party will have to address, and I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that it has been an absolutely extraordinarily important institution in the way that this country has progressed through the last 112 years of federation. I do think that it has a future, but I don't think at the moment that the people who are running it have a clear idea of how it translates itself into the 21st century, and that is something that they are going to have to address.
David, will there be life after this day of death?
Well, the response that Wayne Swan had today was he's got to pack up and go off and finish the budget that he's been hard at work on, and that, of course, is the next big thing for the government. They've got to bring down an extraordinarily difficult budget that has got not only to satisfy financial markets, that they have a clear plot for their for restoring the health of government finances, but more importantly, that sets out an agenda that's funded and that is convincing, that will appeal, inspire, bring hope to an electorate. You know, there's an awful lot hanging over the exercise that they're working on right at the moment. It's an incredibly difficult task that they have because the finances are sick. They have been for some time. They're not getting better. And they've got some huge promises that they've got to get out there and fund and sell and market. And I think that one of the striking features of this government has just been the very great difficulty it has had in selling all its policy ideas and its platform. It just hasn't been able to convince the electorate, and I think that's what the polls have been so clearly showing.
Laura, almost everyone today has been commenting on the absolute anthracite performance of Gillard. She is, as often been said, a very, very tough cookie. I've never seen anyone under such pressure who seems to be so immune to it.
Look, she's extraordinary, as I think we've discussed on numerous occasions, Philip. I mean, how did Norman get out of bed some mornings? I mean, it would have filled most of us, and you know, you can only stand in awe of that. But I don't think voters, you know, I don't think that hits their buttons about whether she's tough or not. They want to know that she's governing competently. They want to have some sense of confidence that she knows what she's doing, and that the government knows where it's going. And the big game changer out of today, going back to what we were talking about earlier, is whether no matter how haphazard and chaotic it was, this gives her the opportunity to get rid of all the Rudd backers in the front bench, so that she doesn't feel paranoid all at the time, that she can change the way she goes about governing, that she doesn't take unilateral decisions, that she's better advised by the very value of cabinet government that makes cabinet government a really good thing, and as a result is more politically savvy, and as a result gains some trust from the electorate.
I think it's fair to say, Chris, that as we look back over the past few months, we suddenly see with absolute clarity what many of us suspected, and that is almost every strategic move that Julia has made has been to head off Rudd. For example, up to and including the declaration of an election date.
The government's been entirely driven by, as Laura says, its own paranoias. That's been one of the real weaknesses of it. And the other weakness is it seems to be absolutely obsessed with day-to-day tactical battles, and I can't really discern any actual strategy that's involved in any of this. It's kind of always revolving around what they think the best thing to do at the moment is. And the one thing I absolutely can't get over is why a government who is in which was in such a weakened position would deal with the media laws in the way that it did. There's actually probably a pretty reasonable argument that a halfway decent government could make to an electorate to say there is a reason why we think that, you know, perhaps there needs to be a little bit of redress on that front. They're not even capable of doing that. It was set down as a fait accompli by the minister. It said that, you know, there'd be no bartering, it'd be done in a week, and we ended up with the absurd situation where it was the independents that were going to be writing the government's laws, and it was going to be happy to accept that if it could get a deal. I just found that whole exercise absolutely astounding, and it did tend to play to what the Rudd people were saying about the Gillard government. This is the Prime Minister routinely makes very bad decisions.
David, I cannot remember an election where both the party leaders are so damned unpopular. There's been quite a few elections where one of the leaders has become toxic and people, you know, welcome the opportunity to kick them out. But here's a case where both Gillard and Abbott are pretty universally disliked.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't know that John Hewson ever really soared in the opinion polls, but maybe my memory's awry on that one. I think Gillard and Abbott have often struck me as two boxers who've been in the ring too long. They know each other's punch and counterpunch, and they're at it daily, and it's just not a very edifying or attractive spectacle for the public at large. But I think that that has been a situation that has always favoured the opposition much more than the government. It's hurt Julia much more to be that combative, because it's prevented her from looking prime ministerial. Mind you, having said that, you know, I'd agree with the comments that both Laura and Chris have made. The problems of Gillard go far beyond those of appearance. They go very much to the substance of her government. But to your point of their unpopularity with the electorate, I think it is just this fact that they've both been each other's opposite number for many, many years, going back to Gillard's time as Labor health spokesperson in 2003 or so.
I'll let you all go to bed shortly, but one other thing that occurs to me, and this is to you, Laura. You and I well remember a period when no matter what John Howard said, no matter what he offered, no matter what blandishments were available, nobody was listening anymore.
Mm.
And it seems to me we passed that point with Gillard some considerable time ago.
Mm. I think we have, Philip. I mean, that's the problem. I can't believe that she can turn this around, because while we might all sort of say, oh, isn't this all fascinating and everything, out in the electorate, and particularly out in the marginal seats, they just aren't interested. You know, they don't listen to anything she says, and they just look at the sorts of things that have been going on today with complete and utter contempt. So, I think you're right. I think whatever she does now, people just roll their eyes.
It's like wriggling in quicksand a bit, isn't it? The more you flail about, the deeper you go. Look, thank you. Thank you, my dears. Laura Tingle, political editor of the Australian Financial Review and author of that fine quarterly essay, The Big Whinge, Politics, Affluence and an Angry Nation. David Uren, economics editor of the Australian, author of The Kingdom and the Quarry, published by Black Ink. And Chris Yulman, co-anchor and political editor for 7:30. Chris is co-author of The Marmalade Files, which we discussed at great length on an earlier occasion. And I have to tell you, Chris, I gave my copy to Kevin Rudd when we were last talking. I don't know what he made of it. Have you heard from his lawyers? Oh, they've gone. Okay. This is LNL on Radio National. Next, we're off to South Africa and the BRICS.